Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome. I am so excited to be here with you this morning. My name is Jason Mack. I'm the one that's been emailing some of you incessantly for the last several months. I just can't tell you how thrilled I am that we're here today. It has been a dream of ours for over a year. And so to have everyone gathered is just exciting. I was going to be happy with 50 and excited with 100, and we're over 150 for the day. So I'm just thrilled. A couple of housekeeping things to talk about as we get settled. We want you to feel at home while you're here. So please bring coffee in, grab a bagel. If you need to get up and stretch and walk around a little bit during the session, that's totally fine. No one's going to be distracted or offended. We want you to be in whatever state you need to be able to receive all that we're going to receive today. So if you need to use the restroom, they're just right out those doors. You need to refresh your coffee, feel free to do that. There are personal sound amplifiers available, and we have a few with us right now. Would anyone like to volunteer that needs one of those right now that might be helpful to hear things? Yeah? Okay, great. And then if not, they're going to be in a little basket right outside the door. There are pads of paper and pens. If you forgot something to write down some things with, you can go ahead and grab one of those and have that available to you. I want to point out the walls. If you look to your sides, these are our idea walls. This is a place, we want this not just to be an information dump to us. We want this to be the beginning of a conversation. So the idea walls are one place for us to talk back, to put our own voice into the conversation. So you can just jot something down, either during a break or during one of the sessions, it's fine. And you know, you write down an idea, and then maybe I come and I look at it, and that spurs an idea in my thinking, and I write down an idea, and then we kind of keep the conversation going throughout the day. So that's another thing that you can do at just at your leisure. Of course, I need to say, turn off cell phones or any other sound-making devices that you carry with you. Let's see, what else did I want to say? There's going to be lots of opportunities for questions, for comments, for, like I said, we want this to be a conversation, the beginning of a relationship. So there'll be plenty of opportunities for conversation and questions and comments. Obviously, we just ask you to be respectful of those who have commented and questioned before you. Well, I think that's all that I have. Will be a quick 10-minute break between the first session and the panel, so you know that that's coming. Is there anything I forgot? If you're part of this church, will you raise your hand real quick? Okay, so these are your hosts. If you have questions, if you need anything, seek out one of these folks and they can help you. Is there anything I forgot to mention? Anybody? No. Okay, very good. Well, I will take now this time to introduce my friend, a friend to a lot of us, Mr. Brian McLaren. I've been in ministry for over 10 years now. I've been a Christian for a little bit longer than that. And I have spent my time in the church recognizing that there are questions that we are all asking. There are struggles that we are all having. There are opportunities and there are problems that the church is facing in this time. And every time I come up against one of those questions, one of those problems, one of those opportunities, I often find that Brian has written something about it. He's either written a book on it or a blog on it or an article. And so I'm really, really thrilled to have the chance to introduce him to some of you, to reintroduce him to a lot of you, and just to give us all an opportunity to hear what he has to say. So let's give a nice big Midwest welcome to Brian McLaren.
Well, good morning. Great to be here with you all. You know, I used to live in the D.C. area. That's where Jason and I got to know each other. And then 5 years ago, I moved to Southwest Florida. And I just feel embarrassed saying that, being here. You know, we complained our cold. I think the coldest temperature that we had this winter was 41 or 42. So I don't even want to talk about that or rub that in at all, but I'm very grateful to be here. I really like traveling up north during the winter because I get to wear a sweater, which just feels great. But I'm very honored to be here, and I'm very honored to be thinking today with you all about the future. And this morning we're thinking about the future of Christian faith, future of the mission and fellowship and teaching and worship of the church. And the way I'd like to frame that in one sentence is to say that we are at a time where certain people are rethinking the whole system of the Christian faith from soup to nuts, rethinking the whole system, looking back over our first 2,000 years as a faith and tradition, and wondering what the next 100 and the next 1,000 might be like. And for some of us, that comes as a bit of a shock, you know. Welcome to the faith. Now here's your complimentary box, outside of which you should never, ever think again. And what often has tended to happen among in different Christian communities is that we had different size and color boxes that we issued. But there's some deep rethinking going on. Of course, this is not only happening in the Christian community. There's a business consultant named Otto Scharmer, some of you might be familiar with. And Otto says, what's missing today is high-quality discourse on rethinking the design and evolution of the entire system from scratch. And when he says the entire system, he doesn't mean the religious system. He means the whole shebang. He means civilization. He means how human beings interact and interrelate. I don't know if you've thought about the degree to which we're being challenged to rethink the entire system. You know, our ancestors a couple hundred years ago, it's as if we stumbled into this huge bank where we found trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars worth of resources in the form of fossil fuels. And we built an entire civilization using dead plants, prehistoric plants for our energy system, kind of a solar energy bank that was put in the earth, 60 to 200 million years ago. And now we're realizing, wow, that bank is now creating problems. There are limitations to it and there are unintended consequences of it. And when you think of the entire global civilization, right as it's maximizing its use of fossil fuels, is having to say there are real negative consequences of that, and we're having to rethink that. That's a big deal. We, in the matter of a couple of centuries, went from being a world of monarchies to being a world of democracies. And now, here in one of the world's most prestigious democracies, we're really wondering if democracy now is in mortal difficulty. We're wondering whether democracy has turned into corptocracy. And we're wondering how democracy can be reborn in our lifetime. I mean, there's deep rethinking that's happening on many, many different levels. But Otto Scharmer adds, the quality of results produced by any system depends on the quality of awareness from which the people in the system operate. In other words, it's not just the quality of your ideas, it's actually the kind of person and the kind of mind and the kind of culture that has those ideas. And Otto and a lot of people who work with him have come up with a way of describing what they think is happening. They're not thinking specifically of religious communities, but it certainly applies. They're thinking, they talk about this with government, they talk about this with business, they talk about this in education, that you're going along and everything is working fine, and then you start getting worse results than you used to get, even though you're working as hard as before. Then you start working harder, and your results get worse, and you keep trying to get back to where you were, and the results keep getting worse. And it's at a certain point in this downward spiral, you give up. You just say, I don't know what's wrong. I don't understand it. I don't have the $39.95 easy program to get back to where we used to be. And you reach a kind of bottom. And at that bottom, possibilities emerge for what could happen in the future. So they often call this the U theory, or theory U, that you go through this kind of downward process. And there's a slowing down process, and then there's a kind of coming to yourself, and then a new beginning that emerges out of this. And it gets described in many, many different ways. But for all of us who are in the Christian faith, this has a remarkable resonance with the Paschal mystery. This has a remarkable resonance with what Lent is all about. In a sense, Lent becomes the process leading to Holy Week, and Good Friday brings us to that bottom point, and Holy Saturday is the silence of having, in a sense, lost. And then Easter becomes the new beginning that emerges right after you've given up hope. One of my favorite ways for expressing this is there's a letting go process with what used to work. And then there's a letting be, where we're just trying to honestly see what's happening. And in that letting be comes a letting come, where now we've, in a sense, emptied our hands of all of our tools and strategies, and we're in a mode of receptivity where the Spirit of God can bring new possibilities to us. Now, we have in our churches in the world, we have a lot of places where churches are working, they're going gangbusters, everything's going great. Especially where pre-modern people are entering the modern world, the Christian faith is growing rapidly. In fact, there are really only two religions waiting for pre-modern people entering the modern world, or largely two, and that's Christianity and Islam. And so these are religions that have figured out how to work in the early modern or late modern context. But where people are leaving the modern world and entering the postmodern world, there's a lot of trouble in religion. Religion of all sorts. Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, Christianity. Religions are struggling when people begin moving out of this world that is sort of centered in the book. One way to identify pre-modern people is they're people who don't have books yet. Modern people live by books. And you always know you're in a modern church because you've got a hymnal and a Bible and a prayer book, you know, a lot of books. Postmodern people, they're the people who've left books behind. And in many ways, that's the world of the screen, and it's the world of the digital connection. And what's often happening is we can have a set of churches working with pre-modern and modern people that are doing great, but wherever churches are dealing with this rapid shift in culture, there's really, really a struggle. And that's where you find the people in this letting go and letting be process. One analogy that I think works quite well is if you think about the U.S. Postal Service. Now, I need to say, people make jokes about the U.S. Postal Service, snail mail, all that kind of a thing. I think anyone who studies U.S. Postal Service has to be incredibly impressed. It's one of the most high-tech organizations in the world. It's one of the most dependable organizations in the world. There's so much to admire about the U.S. Postal Service. It's not their fault that somebody invented email. And if you go back, you even remember this old stamp from 2007, first class forever. There is the sense that one of the most stable institutions in the world was the U.S. Postal Service. In 2001, one of the leaders of the U.S. Postal Service was asked, do you think email is a threat? And he said, email's not a threat. In fact, he said, email is a threat to the telephone. It's not a threat to the letter, which, you know, he pretty much struck out on that one. First-class mail is enormously secure. Some things will never change. There will always be some type of mail delivery. Postal mail is universal. The internet is not. Well, 2001, that was easy to say. But in 2002 and 2003, that's when online bill paying became really, really popular. Some of you feel like that's been around forever. Some of you don't even know what that is. But anyway, by 2010... first-class mail was precipitously dropping, and a lot of this was because of email and because of online bill paying. The result was by 2011, a person on the Senate subcommittee that oversees the Postal Service said, the situation is dire. If we do nothing, if we don't react in a smart, appropriate way, the Postal Service could literally close later this year. And each year since then, the situation has gotten tougher and tougher. 2012, $3.3 billion loss in the first 3 months. And it was interesting. In 2012, U.S. Postal Service started talking about expanding into new businesses. And I've been paying attention to this for years. And that was an interesting moment. That's when you realize we're not going to get the past back. We have to think about a different future. And what that future will be for the Postal Service, I don't know. But making an analogy to churches and other institutions of the Christian faith, seminaries and so on, it's not a perfect analogy, but I think there is something to learn. We could say it this way. Are we in the envelope, paper, stamp, mailbox, post office business, or are we in the communication business? Can we imagine a world turned upside down where we have to ask, what are we really about? I'll give you an example. I was talking to, I do have some Methodists here today. I'm always glad when we have Methodists here because you're here by your own free will. If we have Presbyterians, you were predestined to be here. So the Baptists, you're sort of here by group consent. But anyway, I was talking to a Methodist pastor a couple weeks ago, and he said something. These aren't the exact numbers, but he said that there, if you take all the Methodist churches in the United States, a high percentage of them, I think it was in the 60s, like 62-65% of them, are in rural communities. Okay? And largely that's because Methodists expanded after the Civil War, and they started spreading across the country, planting churches in every county and in every village across the country. And they succeeded right about the time that rural counties had their maximum population. And a lot of people don't realize this, but for rural counties across the country, in the last 100 years, it's been 100 years of population decline as people move from rural counties to cities. And that has to do with mechanization of farms. We need a lot less people to run farms. And it has to do with agribusiness and a whole lot of things. But people end up moving, I'm sure it's true in Wisconsin, moving to urban centers. So I'm just making up this number, but let's say it's 65% of Methodist churches are in rural communities. But now something like 26% of America's population lives outside of, those major urban areas. So here's what he said. He said the job of the Methodist Church is to supply ministers for those buildings where there are fewer and fewer people. So sooner or later, we have to change our job to supply ministers to where the people are, not where the buildings are. Do you see that shift in thinking? That's the kind of shifts that are going on. And it's not just the Postal Service. When you think about what's happened to travel agencies, newspapers, TV news, record labels, even political parties with things like the Tea Party. Now, in a sense, the Republican Party realizes it's not really in charge anymore. The Democratic Party, suddenly realizes it doesn't have a clear conversation partner in the Republican Party. And then we start to realize, gosh, news media start having, or their so-called news media, start having huge impacts on political discourse. And political parties in some ways become subsidiary to media entities. So it's a different world in many, many different ways. And so it's no surprise that in the Christian community, there is this kind of paschal mystery happening. And we shouldn't be too surprised about it. We shouldn't be too upset about it. People who know the Bible know that this movement that goes back to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so on, this movement has had many times when it had a kind of dying and rebirth, or a kind of dissolution and reformation, or when a whole system and a way of doing things ended and it seemed like the end, and that wasn't the end at all. I love the old Charlie Brown cartoon. I hear you're writing a book on theology. I hope you have a good title. I have the perfect title. Has it ever occurred to you that you might be wrong? And Maybe you've seen this one. My stance on it is this, Jesus. Love the sinner, hate the sin. I'll do you one better, Carl. Love the sinner, hate your own sin. So I guess you have some work to do. You know, we're always, if we're Christians, we're in the business of repentance, of rethinking. And that, there are certain times where having the ability to rethink becomes a matter of survival. So what I'd like to do in this session is I'd like to just give you a brief overview of five areas where we are rethinking the whole system. Historical, doctrinal, spiritual, missional, ecclesial, and then liturgical, we're going to save for our session this afternoon. We're going to have a whole session thinking about worship. But I'd like to say something about each of these, just a few brief thoughts. Then we'll have time for questions if you want to explore something deeper, and then we're going to have a whole panel interacting about this. So this is just really to stimulate your thinking. But I'd like to say something about historical. The Christian faith has 2,000 years of history now. Protestantism has 500 years of its own particular history. And there's enough history now that we have a lot to be in denial about. And especially when the people who tell the history have a vested interest in a certain version of that history being told, you only hear part of the story. But now one of the huge changes in our world is we get multiple versions of the history being told, and we start to get a more 3D picture of the history of the Christian faith. And one of the things we're coming to terms with is that our religion has a long history of being complicit in deep injustice. Just about everybody who is a kind of serious, historically aware Christian would know the name William Wilberforce as a great British Christian leader who roused a sleepy nation in England to oppose the slave trade and to outlaw the slave trade in England in the 75 years before our own Civil War. But what people don't realize is that for every William Wilberforce, there were 20 or 30 Christian leaders defending the slave trade. You all might know, in fact, us being in an American Baptist church, Harriet Beecher Stowe, who was married to a Baptist clergyman, she wrote that great book, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which had the effect in the American abolitionist movement of humanizing the slave. But what we don't know is that for every Uncle Tom's Cabin, there were many books like Nellie Norton, which were books that made heroes out of the slave owners and presented the slaves a little bit like the Duck Dynasty guy did recently. Oh, they were all happy back in those days, you know. But thank God, nobody publishes Nellie Norton anymore. They still publish, Harriet Beecher Stowe. But what ends up happening is the ugly voices of our past stop being published and we forget they exist. And then we are surprised when we have to come to terms with historical forces that we are unaware of in Christian history. The history of anti-Semitism, the history of mistreatment of indigenous peoples, the history of colonization. I mean, I'll just tell you, I'm not just trying to be provocative in saying this, but if Americans knew the story, the full story of Christopher Columbus, they would not celebrate Columbus Day. It is an ugly, ugly, ugly story. But we can tell it, you know, in a certain way, and kids don't hear the rest of the story. But the consequences go on. How many of you saw the movie 12 Years a Slave? I think this is an incredibly important movie to see. But there's a scene where there's a white guy who's complicit in and he's a boss or a foreman over slaves, a white slave driver, I guess you'd say. He's not a master, an owner, but he works for the slave master. And he makes a comment that you don't do what I do without it affecting you. And you know, there was one moment in that movie where you realize that the American history of slavery, of course, it had a profound and lasting effect on African Americans, and the descendants of slaves today live with that legacy. White people don't realize that the institution of slavery had a profound effect on them too. Do you see what I'm saying? And the Christian faith is wrapped up deeply with this. And if we lived in Europe, we'd have stories to tell about this in European history. And if we lived in Africa or Latin America or Indonesia or Malaysia, we'd have various versions of it to tell. Not only that, it's not just a history of injustice, but we also have to come to terms with the fact that our religion has changed a lot. A good American Christian today would have been burned at the stake if we put you back 400 or 500 years. Your ideas would be so heretical. Your way of dress and your behavior and your habits would have made you look like a witch or, you know, a demon-possessed person. Can you imagine if someone went walking down the street with earbuds in their ear, talking on a phone? That would look, you know, if we go back in time. I mean, there's so much about us today, our theological ideas, you know. And people make these glib statements about historic Orthodox Christianity without realizing that there has been an awful lot of change in what was considered Orthodox Christianity through the centuries. I remember when I was an English major in university, and when I studied the Middle Ages and realized how important relics were for 1,000 years of Christian history, going to see where St. Stephen's finger was, you know, kept, or a bit of hair. Of course, people like me are always interested in seeing hair in museums. But, you know, what spirituality has meant, what worship has meant, what theology has meant, the assumptions. The Christian religion is a religion that has been amazingly adaptable and is 2,000 years of remarkable change. And when you become aware of that, it makes new things possible. When you suppress that understanding of change, you can keep the lid on things. And when you also realize across our history that if you go from Eastern Orthodox to Roman Catholic to Anglo-Catholic, across all the spectrum of Protestant denominations to house churches and Pentecostal storefront churches, and you see this incredible diversity that exists today, but also over our 2,000 years. I mean, when you study in the Catholic Church how different the orders were and how different the Dominicans were from the Franciscans, from the Jesuits, you just realize that there is a lot of diversity. And when we have this historical awareness, it really liberates us to say that where we are now is not some terrible tragedy and crisis that we've never been in before. We've been in these situations many times before, and we should expect a flowering and blossoming of great creativity at a time like this. It's not a time to be afraid and in despair. It's a time to be hopeful and enthusiastic. But listen, if people don't know our history, and if we suppress the history, we can suppress the options for change. And here it is. And by the way, this is where life gets interesting, because a lot of clergy don't know our history because they went to seminary when only a very narrow version of our history was told. But the irony is every junior high kid in their church can watch the History Channel and sees things about the Middle Ages and Christopher Columbus and he can go to see 12 Years a Slave and start to say, hey, there's sides of our history that have deep theological roots that we've got to come to terms with. Let me say something about doctrinal rethinking our doctrinal system from scratch. One of the things we're realizing is that all theology is contextual. It exists with contextual interests. There are clergy who want to stay employed and paid. They have an interest in how this goes. There are politicians who want Christian faith to turn it one way or another, to support their policies one way or another. So the political context, their economic context, what keeps a what makes a religion, I don't mean to be insulting in saying this, but what makes religion a game that is sustainable? You know, how can you keep the money flowing in? And how can you keep the system going economically? So there's contextual dimensions. Certain ideas raise money. Certain doctrines bring the offerings in, and others don't. So theology in all these ways is contextual. 500 years ago, there weren't too many people worrying about the ecological dimensions of Christian theology. You can't live in the 21st century without caring about the ecological dimensions of Christian theology. I come from a fundamentalist background. I was born hardcore fundamentalist Christianity, and I've been on a journey through my life. But in my years as in the sort of evangelical world, there was this very highly regarded document that came out in the 1970s called the Lausanne Covenant. Have any of you ever heard of the Lausanne Covenant? People from a similar background to me maybe have heard of that. And the Lausanne Covenant was put together by the Billy Graham Institution, and it was an attempt to bring evangelical Christians from around the world together in Lausanne, Switzerland. That's how it got its name. And to come up with a statement about what they were about. And that process was going, and there was a Latin American theologian there, someone I have great respect for, named Rene Padilla, and a fellow named John Stott, an Anglican, British Anglican, was leading the process. And Rene came privately to John and said, "You understand this statement says nothing about poverty. You cannot be a Christian in Latin America and not care about poverty. So if you want this statement to reflect the global Christian community, you have to have a statement about poverty." And when they added a statement about poverty and social justice to the Lausanne Covenant, a lot of the delegates got up and walked out, including a lot of Americans. So you realize that there are contextual and political dimensions to doctrine. And not only that, doctrines have a function of deciding who we won't let in. And so our theological debates have all kinds of interesting dimensions to them. But what's happening in today's world is that we're getting a fresh look at our core doctrines. And we're saying, can we rediscover doctrines not as weapons to threaten people, but as my friend Diana Butler Bass says, the word doctrine is related to the word doctor. It has the idea of a healing teaching. What are the healing teachings that in our context are desperately needed? And what are the healing teachings that the Spirit would have us hear and embody and articulate in our world? And boy, this is an exciting time. It's a very, very exciting time doctrinally. A lot of people are tense and all the rest about it, but it's a very, very creative time. Amazing things are going on. Then we come to the issue of the spiritual system. In other words, what does spirituality look like in a Christian individual, a Christian family, a Christian community? What does the Christian spiritual life consist of? There's a lot of folks in the room who are my age or older. And a lot of people older than me remember when you would never even ask this question. Because what it meant to be a Christian was to go to church. And you went to church, and it all sort of got worked out there. And institutional participation was Christian spirituality. You stood up when you were supposed to. You sat down when you were supposed to. You recited what you were supposed to. You went to confirmation when you were supposed to. You observed the holidays when you were supposed to. And if you just went along with the institution, you got spirituality. And for younger people in the room, that is the most ridiculous thing they've ever heard of. I mean, they can't imagine a world where that was true. So suddenly this category of spirituality we have to think about consciously. Sorry, that's a little hard to see, but a lot of us have been writing about an understanding of spirituality that goes through the age, the life cycle from birth to old age. My friend Richard Rohr talks about the first half of life and the second half of life. I've written about this in terms of simplicity, complexity, perplexity, and harmony, which is very hard to see there. But the simplicity, a kind of dualist stage where we learn there's such a thing as good and evil, right and wrong, in and out. Very, very important stage. It's kind of like basic arithmetic. If you don't get that, algebra won't go well, right? But a whole lot of people, they're only exposed to a form of Christian spirituality that only is interested in those questions. And more of us at younger and younger ages are ready to move on to the second stage of complexity, where we're much more pragmatic and we want to learn how to do stuff. We want to learn how to make our faith work in our lives. We want to learn how to study the Bible on our own. We want to learn how to be involved in social justice on our own. And there's skills we want to learn for the complexities of life. And a whole lot of us spend our whole lives there, but more and more people at younger and younger ages get thrust out of complexity into perplexity. And this is where we go through a real period of critically examining our faith and questioning many of the things we're taught. It's when we say, you know what, this isn't working for me. And we go through this period of critical thinking and sometimes relativistic thinking where we say, well, look, I'm a Christian, but if I'd been born in India, I'd probably be a Hindu. If I'd been born in Russia, I'd probably be Russian Orthodox or atheist or whatever. And so we are working out, how do I understand my own faith? How do I have a critical review of the faith that I inherited? And this stage of perplexity, more and more people hit that stage, especially if you subject yourself to higher education, especially graduate school, because graduate school is really the stage of critical thinking. And so we have a lot of people there. And then we have people who say, well, if I stay there very long, I'm not sure if I have anything left. We have more and more people moving into this new stage that I call harmony, where we learn to integrate the previous stages and we have a kind of integral spirituality where we learn how to put things together. And it's a very, very important process that we go through. And so, interestingly, what was a finish line becomes a starting line. If before the finish line was, we want to get you going to church and tithing and showing up and voting, you know, whatever. Well, that was enough. We got you there. You're a success. But now that becomes a starting line. No, we actually want to help you become a Christ-like person. We actually want you to become an agent of change in the world. We actually want to help you become a person who deepens your spiritual life month by month, year by year. We want you to become a kind of elder and sagely person. We don't want you to just become older. We want you to become wiser. And boy, that changes what the Christian faith is about. It has profound effect on how we do everything, starting with what we do with children and what we expect of children, and it, all the way up to what we expect of clergy and what we hope for clergy. Because if growth is your goal, then you need growing clergy. If stability is your goal, then you just need stable clergy. Very, very different understandings of how we would prepare clergy. Huge impacts on spiritual. Then we come to the missional. And meaning, what does the church try to do in the world? How do we try to do it? What is our goal? What is our aim? And really, if we look at the history of Christian mission, we'd have to say there is a kind of pre-imperial mission. This is what the Christian faith was about before the time of Constantine in the 4th century, when the Christian faith did not have an alliance with the powers of empire. And then by the end of the 4th century, we enter an imperial era where Christian faith was linked with governments in Europe and elsewhere in the world. And that continued up until the present. And in many ways, part of the trauma of the church in America is, and this is still hotly contested, is, you know, you hear people say this is a Christian nation and they expect the state to enforce values that are held for theological reasons. And other people say, no, this is not, that's not what we want. This is highly contested now. But what does it mean to have a Christian mission that is not only, it's not linked with the state, but often is critiquing the state and the powers of economic forces and so on? What does it mean to have mission in that kind of world? And by the way, what does it mean when your primary mission is not the elimination of other religions, replacement with your own, but your mission is to say other religions exist and we have to find a way to work with them for the common good? A whole new ballgame. And many of us would say we're discovering in our lifetime a new era of Christian mission where we have some sense, as our Jewish friends say, to that we're involved in tikkun olam, the healing or repair of the world. And we're, in a sense, mission involves preparing the way, not for us to evacuate from earth to go to heaven, but we're preparing the way for God's will to be done on earth more and more and more as it is in heaven. A very, very different understanding of mission. And then ecclesial challenges, how churches are organized. We know that we've got a history of hierarchy and a history of institution and a more recent history of hierarchy and institution always being oriented around a spectrum of liberal or conservative. You could probably make a case that there's always been something like that, the liberal-conservative polarity. But in the last couple of centuries, that has become, you could say it this way, that whether you're Catholic, Anglican, Lutheran, you know, Baptist, wherever you are, there was a certain sense that there was a liberal stream in all of those and a conservative stream in all those. And we've come to a point where to be a conservative Catholic and a conservative Baptist sometimes gives you more in common than with people of your own religious background who are on the liberal or progressive side. And the opposite would be true as well. And I think we're at a really, really interesting point where, as we're rethinking the whole system, we're realizing that institutions have an important role, but that spiritual movements also have a very, very important role. And one of the things I've been talking about a lot the last couple of years is that we need a theology of movements and institutions. And understand that they're both necessary and that they have an important interaction, but that progress happens when we have movements that transcend and include institutions, and that hierarchies have value. They're probably going to change in powerful ways, but there's going to be dimensions that hierarchies will still exist. And all of this is up for grabs. All of this is in play right now when we think about ecclesial changes. Now, I'm aware that in Wisconsin, you can be a Lutheran or a Baptist or a Presbyterian or a Catholic, and you can be oblivious to all of these rethinkings. I'm aware that that's possible. But I'll tell you, it's less and less possible the younger you go. And I was just telling Jason yesterday, I met a business consultant recently, and he's a retired business consultant. We were having breakfast a couple weeks ago, and he said, Brian, I can tell you all of my years of experience as a business consultant in one sentence. He said, here it is. Any CEO who thinks he can get to retirement without changing won't change. The only time he's going to change is if he thinks, I won't make it to retirement without changing. I'm going to be forced to. Once he realizes that, he realizes, okay, we have to go through some change. See? So it's not just in the religious world. It's in the business world. It's in the political world. But here's what we're realizing. The people who lead our institutions are realizing that on their watch, it's not going to be like 2001 for the Postal Service. 10 years later, you know, things really, really look very, very different. And as I said, we'll talk about the liturgical, some of the deep liturgical changes in the next session. We'll talk about how we're moving from conventional liturgy and even contemporary liturgy, which in some ways are two forms of conformity. One is conform to a past era, and one is conformed to the contemporary era, but we're looking for something now that is creative, that's not just about conforming to a present or past status quo, but that's actually interested in fomenting change in the status quo. And we're going to talk about ritual and ritualism. We'll talk about all this in the next session. Rediscovering liturgy as group spiritual formation for abundant life and transforming mission. You put those together and you've got a recipe for rethinking the whole system. I'll just close with a quote from someone I wish I could have met. He died in 2000. Vincent Donovan. He was a priest from Pittsburgh. He was a member of an order called the Holy Ghost Fathers, and they decided they had a branding problem with the term Holy Ghost. So they renamed the order the Spiritan Fathers. That's kind of a cool rebranding, I guess. And he was a Spiritan missionary in Tanzania, right at the era of Vatican II. And he's just a very intriguing fellow. He went to convert Maasai, and I think it was Shona was one of the other tribes, to Catholic faith. But when he encountered indigenous African culture, he started asking, how much am I introducing them to Jesus Christ, and how much am I introducing them to European culture? How much am I bringing them good news of God's love for them, and how much am I bringing them bad news that they're being colonized religiously along with economically and culturally? And here's what he said. He wrote a very fascinating book called Christianity Rediscovered, where he basically says, in my encounter with indigenous peoples of Africa, I had to rethink my entire faith. It wasn't just about converting them. It was about a conversion of me and a rediscovery of my own faith. Never accept and be content with unanalyzed assumptions about the work, about the people, about the church or Christianity. Never be afraid to ask questions about the work we have inherited or the work we're doing. There is no question that should not be asked or that is outlawed. The day we are completely satisfied with what we have been doing, the day we have found the perfect unchangeable system of work, the perfect answer, never in need of being corrected again, on that day we will know that we are wrong, that we have made the greatest mistake of all. He said, do not merely try to bring others to where you are, as wonderful as that place might be, but do not leave them where they are either. Instead, go with them to a place neither you nor they have ever been before. And I think that is part of what's happening out on the green edge of the Christian faith. I've had the opportunity to be with Christian leaders, obviously cross denominations in the U.S., but also across Latin America, Africa, Asia, Europe. And I just feel so fortunate that I've had these opportunities. And I can tell you, there are huge differences. To be a Christian in Malaysia or Burkina Faso is very different than being a Christian in Wisconsin in many ways. But there are other ways that the struggles we're facing have remarkable commonalities, and that we're all in this together as we look forward to what it's going to mean to be followers of Christ in the centuries ahead. So we're going to open up for questions, and here's the plan. Jason's going to come around with a mic, and if you'll raise your hand, he'll bring you the mic. As soon as that person finishes, Jason's going to look around for who has the next question. So if you'll raise your hand, he'll come to you, and we'll just sort of keep going that way. We're going to try to observe the boy-girl rule, but, you know, to the best of our ability, we'll see how that goes. And we've got plenty of time for some questions now, so thanks for your attention. And if you're nervous about the first question, we'll just skip that and go to the second question. So,
when you talked about history, and you talked about the global church and all that, I read the literature that talks about the Great Revival in what they call the Third World, And the warning is to us guys like us in North America, we're not going to like it when we get there because it's against gays and lesbians, it's hierarchical, it's very fundamentalist. How do you put all that into our rethinking of where we should be going?
It's a great question. So just to repeat the question, there's been a lot of attention to the growth of the church in the third world, what it's often called, or in the global south. Philip Jenkins wrote a book called The Next Christendom some years ago. And then my good friend Wes Grinberg-Michelson wrote a tremendous book a year or two ago called From Something, Times Square to Timbuktu, that is a very good introduction to the global church. I highly recommend that book. And very often where the church is experiencing rapid numerical growth, and here's where it gets complicated, but people often say Africa and Latin America. Here's just to show you some of the complexity there. Well, Protestants say the church is experiencing rapid numerical growth in Latin America. That's because a lot of Catholics are becoming Pentecostal, right? And growth rates are high. So you're experiencing biological growth rates, which give you good statistics. But if you take total church attendance in many places in Latin America, it's not as good as those statistics look. And something similar in Africa. You have high growth rates in a lot of sub-Saharan Africa. You have a high number of people moving from village life where they were primarily animist, tribal indigenous religions, coming to major cities, and the religion that is waiting for them in sub-Saharan Africa largely is Christianity, and a lot of them become Christians in those contexts. But isn't it interesting that these places where the church is growing the fastest, HIV is often fastest growing? I was with a missionary from the country of Zambia a couple of years ago. He had just retired, spent his whole life in Zambia. And I said, he said, yeah, I just retired 40 years as a missionary in Zambia. I said, so what do you think looking back, knowing that that's an impossible question to answer? He said, every indicator of our work was success. Huge numbers of churches, huge numbers of people going to church, huge Christian radio and television, seminaries, all the numbers were good. But every indicator of human well-being is down. So you have to realize these are complicated realities. Rwanda, there was a mission conference, I guess it was the 1980s, that said Rwanda was the best example of Christian success. And then 1994 happens. So here's what I would say. Just remember, it's complicated. And just remember that I'll give you two quick anecdotes. So I was in Uganda a couple of years ago. I was supposed to go to Uganda last year, and my friends in Uganda said, you can't come because you're very outspoken about LGBT equality, and we can't guarantee your safety because people, there are people who are making commitments to kill people who promote LGBT equality. I mean, pastors getting people to make commitments for physical violence. So it's really spooky, some spooky stuff. But they said, so we don't think you should come because we can't promise your safety. But I was in Uganda a couple years ago, and at a conference and organized and run by East Africans, and there were just a few outsiders there. And at the end, a young woman came up to me, Ugandan, who's a journalist. And so she was writing about this gathering. And so she had a little, digital recorder, and she's asked me some questions, records the answers. Then she turns off the recorder and says, can I ask you just a question for myself? This isn't for the story. She said, do you really have hope for the church? And I said, well, I really do, but I'm interested why you'd ask that question. She said, I have no hope for the church in Uganda. She says, I'm a reporter. Can I tell you about a story I just covered? She said, there's a Pentecostal pastor who has a huge church. He stands up one Sunday and he says, the Holy Spirit has given me a word. Someone here has HIV. Well, of course, 20% maybe of the people have HIV. And you've prayed for a healing and God has not given you a healing. The Holy Spirit has revealed to me, you have not gotten your healing because your land is accursed. And so after the service, this little lady comes up and she says, I have HIV, I'm getting very sick, and I own land. I think my land must be accursed. And he says, give your land to the man of God, and you'll be healed. So she signs over the deed to her land to the pastor. And 6 months later, she's sicker. She has to move in with relatives because he's, of course, selling the land for a big profit to help the ministry. She moves in with relatives, and she's almost at the point of dying. And the relatives hired a hitman to go kill the pastor. And this was the story she had just covered. And she said, this is the kind of thing I'm covering all the time. The corruption of the church. You talk about indulgences in the Catholic Church in the time of Luther. She says the corruption is staggering. And of course, there's wonderful people doing great things too. But I just say that to say it's really, really complicated. And when we deal with the issue of LGBT equality, two things to keep in mind from this side of the pond. First, it is remarkable how fast the move toward LGBT equality has happened in the West. I mean, if you're gay, I don't think it's seemed that fast. But in terms of just the general culture, you know, it's pretty remarkable how the numbers have been moving on LGBT equality. And it's very presumptuous for Americans whose grandparents would never have, you know, allowed for LGBT equality to be upset when other people aren't on the same time frame of making change. That's not to minimize the seriousness of the problem. But two things are happening, especially in Africa, but other places in the world too. And one of them is this. You have dictators who maintain power through demagoguery. Now let me, and demagoguery is remarkably popular in American politics as well. But demagoguery is where you're a leader who doesn't have that much to offer, so you create an imaginary enemy, and you promise that you will protect people from that imaginary enemy. And so what happens is when you're a dictator, you need an imaginary enemy, and the West and the colonizers who did terrible things in the past become your constant enemy. And then you can say, this attempt to bring homosexuality to Africa is an attempt by the West to destroy our culture. You know what's funny for me? I grew up fundamentalist. I remember hearing preachers say rock and roll music was an attempt by the Russians to control American minds and make Americans stupid so that they'd be able to conquer us for... You know what I mean? Demagoguery is popular across borders. But all that's to say that there's that meme that's very, very strong going on. First thing. Second thing is to realize that we're in different places culturally. And I think, I'm not a fan of patriarchy, okay? I need to say this to begin with. But patriarchy seems to have had an evolutionary survival value 10 or 20 or 40,000 years ago that has continued. And I think we've reached a period where now it's time for us to leave patriarchy behind. But the opposition to LGBT equality is part of a larger package that is opposition to equality with women. Of men and women. It's part of a larger package of how power is distributed in a society. It's related to patriarchy. And a lot of religious institutions work with patriarchy. Enough said. That's a good question. Yes, next. So I won't be so long-winded next time.
Hi, I'm a boy. Thanks, Brian. Thanks for today, Brian. My name is Richard.
Hi, Richard.
I'm interested in the process of grief when people are going through deep change. Could
yes.
you talk a little bit about how rethinking the system, how's that playing out with people that are connected to the institution?
Yes. Well, you know, you could take Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's stages of dying, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. I think that's it, right? And you can just trace that among denominational leadership over the last 30 years. mainline Protestants were in denial, remarkable amounts of denial, assuming well into the 1990s that they would wake up the next morning in 1957. You know, just remarable. And the strength of mainline Protestants was so great. And can I tell you, mainline Protestants have a huge problem right now, and that is an excess of wealth. Now, they might have a problem of cash flow, but I'll tell you how ugly this is. I was with a denominational official a couple years ago, said to me, we have a lot of churches shutting down in urban centers because it has to do with race and all the rest. These were white, urban, rich churches, and then the white people all moved out, and then there was a racial change of the neighborhood, and the numbers declined, and so finally the church goes out of business, but now it's in prime real estate where areas are being regentrified. And so now they sell that land, and it's worth millions. And they take that money, he told me, we take the money, and we put it in the pension funds for our clergy. Now let that sink in for a minute. The fewer churches there are, the more financial security the clergy have. Is that sinking in? Like, you should be cussing right now, okay? I mean, I'm all for financial security for clergy, but you understand, there's a certain sense that you say, oh, our mission at that point is to provide financial security, and you lose any sense of mission. So there was, it's been a very interesting process, you know, to look back and analyze. But we went from denial to anger. And for liberal Protestants, they would blame the conservatives. And of course, the conservatives were happy because their numbers are growing. It turns out that the conservatives are probably just 35 years behind the liberals. And so, you know, more progressive Christians, I won't call them progressive because they weren't progressive, but they were institutional, and they've had a sort of decline for 60 years now, and probably 35 years later, evangelicals are going to experience a similar kind of numerical decline. And anyhow, the anger, each side blames the other. And then you get to the bargaining phase. Who has the latest church growth technique to get the numbers back in? You know, how can we get young people back in? And it's not authentic. So it's self-preservation. And I remember I get consulted on this. People say, help us understand this. And I say, look, if what you're trying to do is get younger people in the church to keep the institution going, to keep your own job secure, I don't want to help you. You know, this is you're turning young people into fuel. That's not right. So you get through the bargaining phase to this sort of depression phase. And it's very insightful that you raise this question. I have a friend who works. She has a really interesting job. She's a young, she's a young clergywoman who is given the job of being a chaplain to the denominational leaders. It's kind of neat. So her job, she was set apart to say, our denominational leaders need pastoral care too. So she was made available for them. And she just spent 10 days with denominational leaders last year. And she used exactly the words that you used. She said, a year ago, our whole 10 days was about grief. This year, our 10 days was about hope. And there really is something that happens. It's very much that letting be where you say, okay, we're not going to get, the post office will never be what it was when I was a boy. The communication industry's changed. Now, what's possible? You know, and this is where the hope comes, but it doesn't come without grief. And one of the problems I'd say that you should predict in every denomination is that I'm going to guess the youth workers get the grief first. They know that the status quo isn't working. Then the church planters get the grief next. They know it's not working. I think probably denominational leaders get the memo next. They go through grief. But there's an awful lot of people who the wave of grief hasn't reached yet, and it will sort of go through them over a period of time. And one of the things we have to have patience with is that some of us might say, I've been through the grief already, I'm ready for something else, where other people, they're just entering into it now. I was sharing with someone yesterday, I spoke to a bishop of an Episcopal diocese a while ago, and he had just gone through the very difficult process of shutting down 15 churches. Now, Baptists have nobody to do that for them, but Episcopalians, a bishop has that responsibility. And he had a lot of people who couldn't stand him. And it was really tough to do, but they had to do it fiscally. And somebody produced a consultant report from the 1960s where they brought in a consultant advising the diocese, and that consultant had recommended that they shut down those 15 churches in the 1960s. They'd all held on for this period of time. It was a little bit of consolation, you know. But so I guess the point is that it takes time for this grief to set in. But then that prepares new possibilities. Yes?
Hi, Brian. My name's Chelsea.
Hey, Chelsea.
I'm curious about, so you're talking about rethinking spirituality. And it seems like a lot of this is linked to a Christianity that is very individual in some ways. You're talking about fostering Christ-like people and creating individuals to be wiser in the world. And so I'm curious about how you might talk about rethinking local Christian community and how to foster that within a spirituality that is more individualistic.
First, Chelsea, that's a very insightful question, and I'm really glad you didn't. I'm glad you're saying, how do these two fit together? Because we have to fit together individual spirituality with some sort of communal spirituality too. And this is one of our real problems now, because local congregations, as we've known them, are under stress, by and large. And a lot of people then are ready to just say, well, forget that, I'm going to go solo, and I'm going to get my spiritual input through the internet, and I'm going to get my, you know, we have all kinds of individualistic ways to do this. A friend of mine, I met a guy once, he says, I'm a free-range Christian. So he's just given up on the institution entirely, which I can understand why people do that. But so you have this sort of individualistic approach. Here's the problem. I'm pretty sure that actual spiritual formation requires a community of some sort. Now, it might not be a traditional, you know, economic 501c3 entity. See, all these assumptions we have about it, it might not require an organ. I like organs. You know what I'm saying? It might not require stained glass. It might not require a whole lot of things, but I'm going to guess it requires a community. Because virtues are communal. And virtues are only developed in the context of people who have to get along over long periods of time. So I'm really glad you bring that up. And here's where the only thing I can say, Chelsea, is I think we have two things happening at once that some people think are in competition, but I actually think are necessary for each other. We have people who are leaving traditional modes of doing things, and they're creating experimental communities on the fringes. And these experimental communities, because they don't have the financial requirements, et cetera, they can afford to experiment. And we need those. And a whole lot of them fail. You know what I mean? They look like failures, but they're at least tries, they're attempts, which all contribute. The ones that succeed very often are not huge numerically, but they're innovative. And then the existing organizations can imitate those. So we have innovation and imitation. And I think they're both necessary. You can see how they would fit together. And that, I think, is a promising sign of where we're experimenting on what spirituality looks like for individuals, but spirituality also looks like for communities. Okay, we'll have plenty more time for questions after, in our next session. So let me turn it back over to Jason.
So, yeah, we're going to transition over to the panel now. Like I said, if you had a question, you'll have an opportunity to ask it during the panel.